And I always tell people, I'd rather invest with someone with the worst documents and the worst communication, but the best execution, than the best documents and the best communication, but the worst execution. And trust me, I don't like bad documents and bad communication, but I'll take better execution over the latter any day.
Welcome to the RAND CRE Show, commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
What's up, everyone? This is Will Coleman bringing to you the RAND CRE Show. I normally would be joined by my host, Mike Taravella, but he is actually on site doing due diligence. We've recently got a deal under contract and then looking at some larger deals. So I'm in this one on my own, and hopefully Jeremy can keep me in good company. So today on the show, we have Jeremy Roll. Jeremy started investing in real estate and businesses in 2002 and left the corporate world in 2007 to become a full-time passive cash flow investor. As founder and president of Roll Investment Group, Jeremy manages over 1,500 investors who seek passive and managed cash flow investments in real estate and businesses. He is also the co-founder of For Investors by Investors, a nonprofit organization that was launched in 2007 with a goal of facilitating networking and learning among real estate investors in a strict no sales pitch environment, which is rare these days. How's it going, Jeremy?
Good. How you doing? Thanks for having me on here. I appreciate it.
Doing well. Yeah, I've heard a couple of interviews of yours on other shows, and I am excited to kind of pick your brain for some time. So to start off, do you mind kind of giving just a quick short background of yourself and kind of what you're currently focusing on?
Sure. So I guess the best way to classify me is I'm a full-time passive cash flow investor. I've been a full-time passive cash flow investor for about 14 years now. I think we're recording this at the beginning of 2021. And I started passive investing though back in 2002. So I've been doing passive investing for about 19 years, but full-time for about 14 years. The cash flow got me out of the corporate world back in 2007. And that's my number one focus. I really spend all my days networking, looking for opportunities, talking to other investors, other investor groups, looking at sponsors. I'm very highly focused on cash flow and very highly diversified.
Awesome. And I mentioned to you this in the beginning. I heard a podcast where you were on where, maybe a year and a half ago, where you said we're expecting a downturn. Finally did see a downturn. Is this what you expected, or is this completely out of left field?
No, so it's actually amazing that for those of you familiar with the inverted yield curve, that helps to potentially predict a downturn, right? And the yield curve, the inverted yield curve has a range. Like, so in other words, once it becomes inverted, typically the recession within 24 months. And it's, even more probably within 18 months. And the midpoint of the range it was predicting was actually in March 2020. And we started the recession in February 2020, I think, technically. And so it was like almost dead on. Now, it doesn't predict a pandemic. It doesn't tell you why there's going to be a recession, but it's what the market, it's kind of a lead on what the market's feeling is going to happen. And so stuff was already slowing in terms of the economy. We had Trump, who was fighting some slow growth in 2018 that added some stimulus. But that inverted yield curve is what I was using as a benchmark, which worked really well. Definitely didn't expect a pandemic. Also didn't expect this level of government intervention in a downturn for whenever it was going to come, and for whatever reason. So there's been a lot of unexpecteds for sure.
Yeah, and I remember I worked at a bank prior to working here at RAND, and we were watching the inverted yield curve, and our CEO of the bank would always say, the recession is coming and we have to prepare our loans for it. So it is fascinating, and it's shocking how accurate that metric is if you look back throughout the last 50 to 70 years. And could you, I guess, quickly kind of explain what the yield curve means and how it, how it's an indicator of almost sentiment rather than economics?
Yeah, I am not the perfect person to get into the details.
Totally I knew it was a risk asking you that.
I'm just not going to be the best person suited to give you like the full detailed explanation. What I can tell you is that it is really a measure of sentiment, and it is basically a forward thinking. It's amazing when you go back and look at all the history as to how dead on it is. I think it's probably one of the most accurate predictors that you can possibly use. It's one that I really benchmark against. There's a whole bunch of different ones you can look at. But essentially it has to do with the yield on the 10-year versus the 2-year. Some people look at different spreads, but A lot of people will compare the 2-year and the 10-year, and often the 10-year is paying a higher yield than the 2-year because of the time difference. And then when they actually invert, the 10-year, I think, is going to end up below the 2-year. And that actually is a measure of fear. And people going shorter term, more basically getting more and more concerned with having a shorter term outlook versus having the comfort of actually going long term. So not a very good explanation, but a rough explanation anyway. I don't know if you can add anything to it. You might know more about it than me even.
I guess the way that I look at it is people are placing their money where they see less risk. And so if they're placing less money in the short term, that means they see more risk in the short term, and that impacts the yields on the bond. So that's the way I try to think about it. The math behind it, it's always kind of eludes me.
Yeah, but it is true that really all that comes down to is the market telling you that they're fearful in the short term, essentially. Yes. And what's amazing is that if you look at the range of the predictions it normally provides, it's that normally the recessions won't start for at least 6 months. And then the midpoint, it was about 12 months. And the range is normally between 6 to 18 months. So it's a pretty tight range, you know. Now, when you're an active investor in real estate, you can actually make decisions. Or if you're a lender, like you were talking about, you can make decisions. That's fantastic. The challenge I have is that as a passive investor, I get locked into these long-term deals and I can't, I'm a tiny vote in a bigger deal. And so my vote is not very meaningful as on a percentage basis. And it's up to the sponsor sometimes to even decide if they want to trigger a sale and then get the vote to permission of the investor. So I'm in a position where I can't really make a decision very easily. So I actually, if you take a further step back, have been really on the sidelines since the end of 2016, trying to have impact on a very slow moving ship and have some influence as to like something selling. So I pushed the sponsors I was with to sell for whatever my one voice is worth as of the end of 2016, which is when I started to kind of sit mostly on the sidelines. But that yield curve can give you a much tighter timeline to look at that I think is typically pretty accurate.
That makes sense. And how has it been over the past year being a passive investor in, you know, I would imagine in numerous deals, How has it been as you've seen the operators that you've entrusted operating during these times?
Yeah, it's been really fascinating because there's two things that you can really measure in a time like a pandemic. One is communication and two is actual execution, right? You really get a sense in what I would call it an emergency, in other words, a reaction to an unexpected event in that it's an emergency internally for their operations, right? Or it's certainly an unexpected event that they have to all of a sudden just, it's a huge distraction, so to speak, from the day to day. And so what you really get to see is the inner workings of how does someone execute under a very tough challenge? And you also get to see how well does someone communicate in a very tough challenge? Now, mm-hmm. The fascinating thing is that, you know, a lot of investors tend to focus on communication because they want to know what's going on. And I always tell people, I'd rather invest with someone with the worst documents and the worst communication, but the best execution, than the best documents and the best communication, but the worst execution. And trust me, I don't like bad documents and bad communication, but I'll take better execution over the latter any day, right? So it's been fascinating to see how the different sponsors have had different levels of communication, how they changed the amount of communication they've done, depending on how close we were to the beginning of the pandemic versus when things stabilized. I also saw one very fascinating thing, which was which normally happens in the downturn. You know, everybody talks about, oh, there's so much liquidity around. And even if there's a downturn, there'll be a ton of liquidity there to invest, right? So everyone's like, oh, the prices won't adjust much into a downturn because there's going to be a ton of liquidity, so much cash on the sideline. Well, the reality is that's not how it works psychologically in a downturn, right? Mm. We have fear. We have people running for the exits. We have people running to cash. We have people seeing the stock markets, stock portfolios go down. And we actually saw that in March. It was fascinating. I saw sponsors, very large sponsors, who had $50,000 minimum investments, who were in a couple, there was one in particular who had two deals and a contract they must have gone hard on, who immediately reduced their minimum from 50 to 25. I mean, this is a sponsor that in another time would have raised that money in like 2 days, right? Yeah. And they couldn't raise it. And it was just, I was like, oh yeah, there you go. Like people wouldn't believe that's happening, but that's actually happening, especially under that brand, right? So a lot of things were kind of shown and became obvious. And it was a very interesting time to definitely be part of, for sure.
Yeah, I really like hearing you say that because I think you hear that story constantly of there's so much liquidity on the sidelines. You know, the prices are not going to go down because there's so much money moving into the market. And That's definitely, there's probably some truth to that, but people discount fear and they discount how hard it is to deploy capital when there's fear in the market.
Yeah. And actually today is a really good example of what's going on, even on the non-real estate side. We're recording this on a day where like Powell didn't address a challenge with interest rates going up and the market reacted poorly. And what we saw is a sell-off of gold, silver, and Bitcoin, right? These three things with the market. And everyone would say, oh, get into gold, it's a hedge. Get into Bitcoin, it's a hedge. That's not the way it really works, right? And neither is it the way that it really works, that there's so much liquidity around that these prices aren't going to adjust. You have to look at what really happens in the domino of what happens in the cycle. And in the case of gold, silver, and Bitcoin, what generally happens is that people's stock portfolios start to go down. Some of them have margin. They're going to liquidate gold, silver, and Bitcoin to cover margin or just out of fear. It's one of the two, right? But it happens and they're correlated. So yeah, it's really interesting to see what happens during these very unusual times.
Since you brought up Bitcoin, I mentioned I might allude to it. And any summarizing thoughts on it or any opinion you have on it?
Bitcoin is so tough because on the one hand, and here's the thing, there's 1,000 opinions, none of them are necessarily wrong. I'm a very kind of hardcore, low risk, passive cash flow investor because I live off the cash flow. So it's hard for me to lock my money into an asset like that for 10 years on pure speculation with no cash flow. That's the tough part for me. What I really like about the way Bitcoin was designed is that it's a limited supply and it's a finite supply that's been defined. And I really like that they did that, right? And I think that's one of the reasons why it's at the current levels in the high 40,000s right now. On the other hand, every bubble ends 100% of the time. There has not been a bubble in history that hasn't burst eventually. And when you look at ratios for the stock market and for other metrics, there is a ton of evidence supporting the fact that we're in a very big bubble right now, almost to the extent of the dot-com bubble, depending on which ratios you look at. Some of them are higher than dot-com, some of them are lower than dot-com, right? And dot-com was quite an extreme bubble. Mm-hmm. I believe that in retrospect, I hate to say it, and I could be wrong, but I fear that Bitcoin and other things are going to be like, so at this time, when you have Tesla in the past couple of years being worth more than most of the major auto manufacturers combined, yet actually not actually operating they're operating at a loss except for government tax credits, right? If you look at Bitcoin, the way that it shot up out of speculation and a lot of the stimulus money going towards that, right? If you look at GameStop and all the Reddit stuff that's going on, in retrospect, you're going to laugh at all those and say that was ridiculous. It was ridiculous that Tesla was worth almost all the major auto manufacturers combined, right? Oh, it's ridiculous that Bitcoin shot up from 10,000 in, you know, five times in the last 6 months, right? Which are true numbers. It was ridiculous that GameStop shot up, you know, 50 times. Like it was obvious, actually, in retrospect. I have a feeling that these are the signs that it's going to be obvious. And I don't know for sure, but I just know bubbles eventually burst and they can last a very long time. So nobody knows the timing. And I feel like Bitcoin will eventually burst. Now, does that mean it's going to go down to 30,000 or to 3,000? I don't know, right? But I do think that it's very high right now. And actually, at the time in which we're recording this right now, which is right at the beginning of March, my anticipation is that it's possible that the next round of stimulus checks that will probably be approved around mid-March and maybe start to go out right after that, maybe the last final push up the leg up of Bitcoin, for example. And without any more stimulus in view, that might be the last push for the stock market too, because that's really been propping it up and the last push for a lot of these day traders. And so that weren't professional day traders. So sorry for the long answer, but we'll see what happens. It's all speculation. Nobody knows for sure.
Yeah. And I do love hearing both sides of the coin, because I think the majority of people we'll speak to are mostly positive in terms of, we're seeing good collections, we're doing well, still getting returns, we're still actively raising funds. And I'm sure there are people that are doing well, but it is nice to hear kind of the reality of a lot of situations and hear both sides of the coin and see what makes sense. So in line of that thinking, I say this all the time on the show, Howard Marks is probably my favorite economic thinker. And he mentions that we're in the lowest return, highest risk environment he's probably ever seen. Mm-hmm. So how are you reacting in this environment? Are you, so Howard says that he's investing cautiously. Mm-hmm. So that might be a good way to phrase it. Are you completely on the sidelines? Are you investing? Or like, Are you looking for yields right now? Kind of what are you doing to in this environment?
I'm always investing, but what's really hard right now is what makes sense to invest in right now, right? And for those of you out there who know how Mark Seeds, great guy, like, and very knowledgeable, his opinion is worth a lot more than mine. So I mean, that's just a fact. So, but the bottom line is what I'm doing is I'm saying to myself, look, I'm concerned about asset price decreases, rent decreases after eviction moratoriums go, after state and local rent subsidies are gone, after government intervention's gone, what is this entire thing going to look like, right? So from that perspective, you bring me in a random market rate deal, I'm not interested because I'm waiting. And I don't think I'm going to have to wait much longer. They can't keep printing money forever if the pandemic starts to get better, and it is starting to get better now with the vaccines. And so bottom line is that I don't think I'm gonna have to wait much longer. So the risk reward of me waiting is actually really good, I think. Like, it's very low risk for me to wait for a small amount of time for potentially high reward, right? So I'm gonna wait and see if prices adjust and NOIs go down and cap rates adjust and all this stuff. In the meantime, what I am doing is I want to avoid anything where I think the asset value, the underlying asset value, can go down, okay? So what I'm trying to focus on is very short-term stuff, because I do think with this next wave of stimulus and with the government continuing to kind of float things here in a little bit, I think that, for example, the housing market, which I think will adjust at the end of the year, the beginning of next year, unless the government extends some things, I think that I have a pretty decent runway for some hard money lending, some short-term flips. I've restarted that now. I kind of was on the sidelines of that last year for the most part. I've restarted a little bit into the summer season. Number two is I'm looking at stuff that has a very quick payback period to reduce risk. So this is not real estate related, but I'm involved in some debt consolidation type of things, but the payback period is about 14 to 16 months. And I don't think if we had a little bit more of an economic downturn, it'd be impacted that much. So, but that quick payback period is a security measure for me, and also great to get that cash back quickly to be able to redeploy it in what I think might be a better time. Right. I also invest in some ATM machines, which are a similar profile. And I've been investing in ATM since 2008. The payback period is a little bit longer. It's 4 years. But with the 100% bonus or depreciation, if you have a pretty high tax bracket, you can get over 50% of your cash back in year one if you could take advantage of the depreciation, for example. So again, and I don't think I've actually been through two cycles with those ATMs already, and they perform very well. So, you know, stuff that I think will do well, even if we have a bit of an adjustment down. And especially stuff where I'm not, and by the way, I didn't even mention, like, ATMs are going to depreciate to zero. I don't care if their values go down. I expect their values to go down. Where I get worried is if I'm investing in ABC real estate and the value goes down in the next year or two. I should have waited, right? So I'm trying to kind of do a lot of things I don't normally do to make sense of making investments, because I normally much prefer to be in the cookie cutter ABC building with diversified tenant base. It's 80 to 100% occupied, stabilizing, cash flowing. I go to sleep tonight, wake up tomorrow, not much has changed. I'm living off the cash flow. That's really what I look for. Can't do it right now. But I don't think I'm going to wait much longer to see what the market looks like once all the government intervention's gone.
Mm-hmm. So I guess to touch specifically on multifamily and more mm-hmm. specifically in the Southeast, you know, I'd say collections have been relatively stable, but are starting mm-hmm. to dip. I'm a mortgage broker. I don't even think I've discussed that with you, but a lot of the T12s and owners I speak to, you know, delinquencies are maybe 4 to 7%, where they used to be 2 to 3%. So you're seeing slightly more in terms of delinquency. Rental growth is certainly, it's still happening in a lot of the markets that we're in, Tennessee, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina. But it's probably much more limited. So multifamily specifically in the Southeast markets, how big of an impact do you think, or how much of a price adjustment do you kind of foresee happening?
Sure. Look, take pandemic away for a second and say we just had a regular recession and there wasn't really there was just a normal amount of government intervention or whatever that's worth. I would have expected to see a potential adjustment of between 150 to 250 basis points in a typical class of asset. Okay. And I invest in class B, so that's the one I'm commenting on. But, you know, just to give an idea, right? So if we had a 150 to 250 basis point adjustment, which, by the way, includes the fact that interest rates are heading up right now, and that could be part of the reason, that would be what I would call typical. So if I'm not seeing 150 basis points, that's not typical. And if I'm seeing over 250, that's not going to be typical, I would say, of a typical downturn. So that would be what I would expect, because that's typical, that's historical. And so we'll have to wait and see. I am completely uncertain as to what's really going to happen. But here's what I can tell you. What's so fascinating, and you'll appreciate this, I've been told, and I've asked a lot of sponsors, right now, if your building is being 10% subsidized by local and state rent subsidies, and you're looking at a deal to put on a contract, are you able to find out what percentage is actually being subsidized by the government that may come to an end? And you're able to negotiate part of that because those that rent may not be there in 6 months? And their answer is no, because there's 10 buyers behind us, and so we can't negotiate it at all. And so in some cases, we can't even get that information from the seller. They don't want to bother with us. I'll just move on to the next buyer because of such the supply and demand imbalance right now. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things I'm keeping my eye on to see what happens. It's interesting, delinquencies are up. I mean, why would they be up considering that the economy is restarting and the government's still subsidizing everything? Can you imagine what's going to happen when they don't subsidize everything? We don't know. It might not be bad. It may be worse. And so from my perspective, again, risk reward, if I only have to wait 6 to 18 months to figure all this out, then that's not very long, in my opinion. You know, I actually, just to comment on the Southeast, I really love the Southeast for a number of reasons. You know, a lot of population migration is expected to happen into those locations in the next 10 years. So those should be some strong markets, depending on the exact location, exact city. And so that's kind of my perspective. I think that multifamily as a longer term play is one of my top four and favorite asset classes, period, for more stabilized cash flow. But the short term is a little murky as in terms of what's going to happen.
Makes sense. And something that I think a lot of people don't think about as well is the operating expenses. So taxes, insurance, repairs and maintenance, I think those are going to go up a little bit faster than some people may think, on top of, you know, rents kind of staying steady, which, you know, just something to think about.
Yeah, and rent, by the way, I'm expecting rents to go down. And I've only seen once ever in all these years a performer that showed rents going down for a recession in a given year that the person, that the sponsor thought, because that's not reality. Rents do go down in the downturn, right? Vacancies go up. And so I'm expecting vacancies to go up once the rent subsidies stop, right? And once the stimulus is much reduced, that's just reality. That will cause reduced NOIs, and it should also cause increase in supply and therefore increase in vacancy. So,
So you've been through a number of cycles and bubbles and recessions. Does this feel similar to the other three, you know, 01, 07, and now 2020? Is it feel similar? What are kind of some similarities and differences?
Yeah, it feels nothing like it. And the reason is because I think we would all agree that the government didn't step in as quickly as it did, the stock market wouldn't be where it is. Real estate wouldn't be where it is. So this is the first time I could tell you that I think we're like literally 100% government driven. So all that matters at the moment, really, I mean, with the odd exception, is what is the government going to do, right? Which is really weird, because as an investor, it's much easier for me to invest, and it's much more predictable. The government isn't involved only because I can look at the free market dynamics and actually apply historicals and look at these 150 to 250 basis points and all these other things that typically happen that I can apply, right? So it becomes much more challenging for investors to understand where we're going as a result of the government, because it's all artificial. It's someone artificially stepping in and changing things that typically, and adding things and subtracting and doing things that aren't normally there, like eviction moratoriums, right? So this has definitely by far been the most challenging recession for me to sort out, as far as where things are going to head. And it's certainly been by far the most unique one for many reasons. And it's probably been the most challenging one from a societal perspective by far. And actually the one that blows me away, the statistic, is that the initial jobless claims, I still don't think we've hit 1 week since this pandemic started. It's been a year that we are actually, I think the highest week of initial jobless claims, which is new unemployment claims in the US, in 2007 recession, I think the highest week was still lower than the lowest week we've had for this entire recession, for every week, which is mind boggling. And the unemployment statistics look great because they stopped counting people for all these reasons, including which they've been out of the workforce for a certain amount of time. They haven't actively looked for a job in 4 weeks. If their hours have been reduced, they're not counted as having any effect. And so it's amazing how deceiving it is when you look at the unemployment number that happens to be quoted versus, and you know, the government actually has multiple measures. You can go look at the more real unemployment when you start adding these things back in. But it's a very unique time where everything looks fine, but it's because government has stepped in and it's all that matters at the moment.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing. I check the CNBC webpage all the time because they post that chart of initial unemployment claims as well as continued unemployment claims. It's one of my favorite numbers to reference, and it is quite amazing. And a lot of people that I speak to will say the same thing. They'll say the market doesn't make sense. It's like it's not doing what it should be doing, and you know, it seems to come to the same conclusion that it is at some level propped up by the government. It's just how long can the government prop it up, and then how will the market react once that is not there? You know, can you, you know, almost like it's almost like giving medicine to a child as they're sick. Eventually, you have to take the child off the medicine, and will it heal itself, or you know, what will happen to it? So it is fascinating, and
The government can't afford to give the child medicine forever. And that's the problem, right?
Yep.
So the question is, did they give the child medicine for long enough that the child healed itself? Or are we going to find out that the child's still quite sick and they can't really keep feeding it the medicine? And we don't know. But that's why I was saying before is that as an investor, we don't have much longer until we find out. By the way, I want to make a suggestion for you and anyone who's listening. CalculatedRiskBlog.com. I don't know if you've ever been to that website. It's great for charts. So calculatedriskblog.com, they publish data every day. That's all they do. They're somewhat unbiased. I think they're a little bit positive slant. They don't comment it very much, but they actually keep the data from way back. And you can look at these charts much more easily on there than because I look at CNBC as well. But if you just want to look on a Thursday every you can, it's really handy to just go there. It's very easy.
Awesome. I will definitely use that. That's very helpful because pretty much CNBC and just going to the Fed's website is what I'll do.
Well, obviously you can go to the Fed's website, but calculators, you'll see what I'm talking about. They have a lot of different things that they measure and they just make it very easy because they keep charts going back years for all these different pieces of data.
So. Sure. So last question here before we go to our pro tip. Thoughts on inflation? Are you worried about inflation? I know it's a crystal ball type question, but you'll have a better answer than most, I think.
Okay. So to me, I think you have to separate inflation into two components. I think you've got like the day-to-day, you know, cost of living expenses. And I think you have asset prices. And I know that overlaps a little, but to me, they're just different, right? So inflation on the cost of living side, I think is going to go up a little bit. This is due to shortage of supply. There's going to be a massive increase in demand as things open back up. And so I think that in the short term, that could be a bit of an issue. I think the asset price inflation is where it's at. And I think that's where all this money printing has affected already with the things are propped up. We mean asset prices, right? And so I think that's going to be a continued theme ongoing. And that typically is what happens as you grow and grow and grow your debt, unfortunately, and then you debase your currency, right? So I do expect asset prices to be continuing to go up long term. In the short term, they can go down, right? I'm expecting a potential some type of adjustment. We don't know what's going to happen, but we've been talking about it this whole episode. But in the long term, I'm definitely expecting the gap between the rich and the poor, unfortunately, to continue to go up as a result of asset price inflation, right? And so I think the US government can't afford for the interest rates to get out of hand, and they can definitely manipulate them and control them. They just have too much debt. So I personally don't think the interest rates are going to get too much higher from here, and eventually the government will step in anyway. And so I'm expecting a long-term, very low interest rate. But you know, things can happen in the short term in the meantime.
Perfect. That's very insightful. And I agree with almost everything you've said. So before we go to our pro tip, we will take a quick moment to hear from our sponsors. And we're back. So if you could leave the listeners to our show and investors one pro tip, what would that tip be?
I would say, you know, we're in a bubble. We don't know when it's going to end. Don't be deceived. 100% of bubbles end. So be very cautious right now. I'm always telling people to be cautious, but it's just so obvious at the moment. And I don't just mean with Bitcoin and the stock market. I also mean with real estate. That is in a completely propped up artificial scenario right now. And I would tell you that, you know, your risk is much lower once you wait to see what happens when the government's done. And we don't think we have too much longer for that. So just be cautious right now, especially right now in early 2021.
Proceed with caution. I think that's the takeaway.
Yes.
Well, Jeremy, I appreciate you coming on the show. This has been very exciting for me and very interesting. One of the more interesting podcasts I've done in a while. So I appreciate you coming on. If anyone did have questions for you or wanted to learn more about what you do, what would be the best way to get in touch with you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks again for having me on. Hopefully this was helpful for your listeners. So easiest way to reach me is through email. Don't hesitate to reach out to me. I'm happy to network with anybody or help any way that I can. My email address is jroll, J-R-O-L-L, at roll investments, R-O-L-L investments with an S.com. So jroll at rollinvestments.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Jeremy. And all right, folks, there you have it. Another edition of the RAN CRE show. We appreciate everyone joining us. If you have any questions or things you'd like to see more of, shoot us an email at info@rancre.com. Make sure to leave us a rating, review, and comment wherever you listen to podcasts. And we will see you next week.